Good evening, wherever you are. Thank you very much for joining us on the 80th episode of Just Like the Movies, where one of the few rules we do have is you can't talk enough Mel, and that's what we're doing today. We're talking about the 1999 Mel Gibson neo-noir, I guess you could call it, Payback, which a lot of people may be aware was adapted from a 1967 Lee Marvin movie called Point Blank. But this was a little more, you know, at the time it seemed a little more, I don't know, it seemed darker than it really was in retrospect. But we'll talk all about that with the man on the program who definitely more closely resembles Mel Gibson. That'd be Johnny. Johnny, how you doing, man?
Utah! Give me two!
When are we doing Point Break, then? Is that what we're, is that what we're doing next?
Oh, it was Point Blank. I'm sorry. Jeez. I hope this doesn't make the final cut of the podcast.
This is how we're going to start already.
That was like a bad Norm MacDonald on the couch of Conan bit.
There is no such thing as a bad Norm MacDonald. Please back. I don't want to get confrontational about it. Please take that back about Norm MacDonald.
Though off air, I think it was off air. We both came to the conclusion that his movies were pretty ass. So we probably won't be doing his movies, but we still love Norm nonetheless.
Yeah, Norm rules. I mean, yeah, Dirty Work had its moments. That Screwed movie was terrible, but we're not doing a half-assed Norm MacDonald podcast. Some days I really wish we fucking were, but instead we're supposed to be talking about Payback. So
yeah, yeah. Yeah, I like Payback. I remember owning it on DVD. I don't know if I saw this in the theater. I might have, because, I mean, 1999, like, looking for things to do on a weekend with your friends, like, the movies is up there. And it didn't always have to be like, oh, I've been dying to go see this movie. It might be fucking Spice World. It might be it might be Species 2. It might be a good movie like Payback. So I may have seen this in the theater, I'm not sure, but I do remember seeing it around the time it came out, and really enjoying it. And I'm no expert on the, you know, genre of noir films. This feels like, you know, reminds me of like a non-sci-fi Blade Runner in a weird way, with the narration and the blue tones and that sort of stuff. But it's a simple movie. Like when I rewatched this, I didn't realize how, aside from the real environments and city environments, there's no big, like, massive, like, action sequence. They're all very subtle, small things. But it's a really entertaining movie nonetheless. And you can't go wrong with, you know, prime Mel Gibson, which I still consider this to be part of his prime era, 80s into 90s, and with a touch of 2000. But
yeah, when was the line of demarcation? Was it when he did What Women Want?
I was thinking like 2005, yeah, something like that.
Or probably. Was it when he directed The Passion? It was like, okay, we got a different Mel now. Like it was always the same Mel. It's just he had the money and the freedom to tell it, to show everybody who he really was.
Yeah, 2004, Passion of the Christ. But I remember that being still received like really well at the time.
No, I think it's just a line of demarcation. It's not bad or good. It's just, I think that was kind of the end of matinee idol Mel Gibson.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And then the tapes probably came out a couple years after that, so
yeah. What does he say on those tapes again? I forget.
Oh, man. what are you looking for?
Give it to me. Give it to me.
You make me want to smoke!
There it is. And smoke he does in this movie.
Oh, dude, so for people who, maybe we've mentioned it once or twice, Johnny and I have both indulged in whatever you want to call them, heaters, burners, Rons, squares. We used to be habitual smokers. And I actually have not had a cigarette in almost 5 years, and you can save the ticker tape parade for later. But watching this movie, I was like, man, those cigarettes look incredible. Like, everybody's just smoking and looking like they're just not just enjoying it thoroughly, but like their basic cellular functions would cease if they were not like taking hits of the cigarettes down to their cornhole and then exhaling very slowly.
Yeah, with that very dramatic, sexy aura of smoke swirling around Maria Bello's head, you know, from an exhale from Mel Gibson. But yeah, it definitely has that old school feel to it. And I think cigarettes are like a requirement, because I even think of like another neo-noir film that came out a few years after this, Sin City, based on the graphic novel, and everyone's doing these very monotone self-narrations while taking down heaters. And it's just like, that's the 1940s to 1960s neo-noir style detectives. Everyone had a cigarette in their mouth, walking down a rainy, cloudy, foggy street. And this movie captures that feel, and the music too. The music has a very old school jazzy type of feel to it. So this feels very retro, to the point where I was watching at the very beginning, looking for signs to assure myself that this movie wasn't set in the 70s, because it does just, it has all the feels of a 1970s type of movie, in my opinion. I don't know about you.
I think in a lot of ways, I mean, this movie is supposed, well, it's adapted from a movie that was made in the late 60s, and then a lot of those 70s, there's a lot of these little random Easter egg things, like the supposedly the theme was inspired by the taking of Pelham 123, the one bar that they meet, that Resnick meets Stegman in, is called Varick's. That's a reference to Charlie Varick, which came out in 1973. We mentioned that a couple times on the show. It's a Quentin Tarantino hidden gem favorite as well. You mentioned the that you thought you had this on home video. Like, this was one of those movies that I remember that it was kind of like Fight Club. Like, when we all kind of, everybody who's kind of within our age range, plus or minus 3 years, like, they started getting their own places in the real world, and dorm rooms, and then your own places in the real world. It seemed like there was a copy of Payback in every guy's apartment that I hung out in. Like, there was always, it was like this, Fight Club, and I don't know, maybe Goodfellas or The Godfather, but it was like, it was almost like required reading for like the first real world place for people of a certain generational cohort or sub cohort, as it were.
That's a good point. I definitely had this movie on DVD, and it was like about a year or around a year or so after the DVDs came out. And it was just like buying DVDs, like they weren't super expensive in comparison to VHSs. And it just felt cool to have a disc where you can be like, oh, I can play scene 17 if I want to right now, and I don't have to fast forward. It was like this phenomenon. And the special features, outtakes, like DVD culture was like, it's burned into my brain how much I loved it when it first came out.
I miss it too, man. I miss it every time I try to fast forward or rewind a movie on Prime or something, and it just crashes. Because it can't handle it. It's just like...
Yeah. Did you watch this on Prime?
No, I watched it on my private repository. What about you?
I fired it up on Amazon because I wasn't exactly sure if it was on my private repository, as it were. But nonetheless, I did not know that there was a drama with this movie.
Yeah,
let alone this director's cut that's apparently vastly different. Never heard of it. And that came out apparently in 2006. I imagine it's a very little fanfare, or else I probably would have heard of it. But did you? Yeah, you said you didn't know either. So very interesting. Let's knock that out of the gate.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good place. I also wanted to kind of just reiterate another thing you were talking about, how the movie kind of has this weird retro feel where you can't really put it in modern day. And they mainly do it with rotary phones, and some of the cars are newer. But some of them are in that era. And also, like, when, you know, one of the lines where Resnick says, no, President Nixon. Of course, Stegman. Like, he's talking like Nixon's still in office, which is kind of funny. Or it might have been something somebody said just off the top of their head. But, yeah, you brought up the drama with this movie. What did you read about it? Or what can you remember off the top of your head?
Unless I read something that was fugazi or I misconnected dots, the director obviously also directed LA Confidential, won for LA Confidential, but was still fired shortly after the Oscars while making this film. Is that,
I think he,
way
no, of, he won the Oscar for writing the screenplay.
LA Confidential.
Yeah. Different guy directed LA Confidential. I think his name is Curtis.
Okay. Hansen, so he maybe? Won for writing, but still nonetheless Oscar winner gets canned. And it sounded like, because I looked at the credits and he still has the director's credit, and that could be a union thing. It could be in the contract. You know, I've seen movies get finished by other people where the first person still gets director's credit. So I'm not sure if, like, did Mel Gibson take over this sort of like a Russell, Kurt Russell in Tombstone type of thing?
This is very much a Mel Gibson giveth and Mel taketh away situation, because when this movie, how it came to into existence was because Brian Helgeland was working on the script for it. And he works pretty closely with Richard Donner, who has that connection with Mel Gibson through the Lethal Weapon movies, and right. of course, Conspiracy Theory, which he was working on at the time. And they ran into each other by chance, because Richard Donner basically sent him on an errand. He's like, they were doing an ADR session for Conspiracy Theory, and he's like, tell Mel I'm going to be late. And he had a script under his arm, and Mel asked him, well, what's that? And he's talked to him about it, and then he read the first act, and he said he really liked it. And then later on, he said he asked him if he could be ready to go in 12 weeks, and he was going to star in it. So there really wasn't a lot of alternate casting drama with the Mel Gibson part. So if you think no one else could have pulled this part off, well, there wasn't really a choice for Mel Gibson. But in any event, so that's how the it's interesting because that's how the movie started. And then by the end, Mel Gibson had soured on his vision of the film so much that the thing was it was in post-production and he got fired. Like, the movie was finished. And then he had won the Oscar. That the Oscars are always on a Sunday. So the Oscars were that Sunday, and then that Tuesday he got fired. And they brought in, they don't even really know for sure because there's conflicting information, but it wasn't Mel Gibson. There were two other guys. One was like the production designer, I think, and then, or not the production designer, but there was somebody else who worked on the film, and then there was somebody else they brought in named Paul Abascal, who said that he shot the reshoots, but 30% of the movie was reshot. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that you had to remember, it's hard to remember back when what the late 90s were like, but this movie was really kind of dark. Especially, I mean, you got Mel Gibson kind of playing against type, more of an anti-hero. Yeah. He's only really likable in comparison to all the other characters in the movie.
Yeah, and they even say on the cover of the movie, get ready to root for the bad boy.
Right, yeah, but the thing is, that was all done later because Brian Helgeland's original vision of the movie was a little darker and more ambiguous. And I'm not going to really... I wanted to watch the alternate version before this, but I just didn't make time for it. And I do want to see it someday. But I don't know if it would be a better movie, but I definitely don't think it would have done as well it would not have been as commercially successful in the late 90s as the original version would have been. And that was pretty much Mel Gibson's call. So it's kind of, it's used as a negative connotation, but like they kind of Hollywooded it a little bit. Like that was how, you know, for people who don't like the Kris Kristofferson character, he wasn't in the original at all. He was added later as kind of like this primary antagonist, and then they changed some of the scenes around. Like Mel Gibson, when he, confronts his wife, there's it's a little bit more like Ike Turner-y. Like he beats her up a lot more. Like the actress Deborah Unger actually broke her ribs when they were filming the original scene that didn't even make the movie.
Jeez.
And if you're wondering how a dog gets shot at point blank range and lives, it's because that was a change they made. They didn't want to kill a dog.
Yeah, that dog was dead.
Yeah. So, like, I'm not going to get into, like, I know that's kind of a lot, but, I mean, they reshot 30% of the movie. Like, they changed the whole ending. They brought in a new villain to kind of play off of. So they made
a video game.
What?
Didn't it feel like a video game? Like you get to one boss and then you get to the next boss and then there's his boss and it's just like there were like tiers that he was conquering throughout this movie.
Yeah, it was very
You see William Devane, you're like, oh, he's the guy? Okay, he's the guy in this one. And then it's like, oh no, wait. We have Kris Kristofferson is the real villain. It's like, what, how many tiers does this company have?
It's a proper criminal organization, which I found out was a reference to, it's one of the things that puts this movie in Chicago, and a lot of it was shot in Chicago. Some of it was shot in LA. Might be hard to tell through the blue tint, which kind of adds a little character to the movie, I think. Cause Mel Gibson said he would have preferred to shoot the movie in black and white, but he couldn't get the studio to go for it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I guess eagle-eyed viewers who maybe have a better grasp of geography and have spent more time there might notice some of the like Chicago landmarks. I didn't, but
I did not. No. Well, it's funny you mentioned about, you know, no other alternate castings. And did you catch what Roger Ebert said about the movie?
No.
He gave it. It didn't get great reviews.
Like,
it was
yeah. It got like a B minus cinema score, which is not like that's a pretty soft scale. So that's not great.
Yeah, it was pretty split with critics, but Ebert gave it 3 out of 4, and he said, quote, "There is much cleverness and ingenuity in Payback, but Mel Gibson is the key. The movie wouldn't work with an actor who was heavy on his feet or was too sincere about the material." So I found that to be an interesting quote, because I don't know if he's saying, like, Mel Gibson brought a slight, like, winkish, like, self-awareness to the role, like, sort of playing like this cliche type of character or something like that. But I do see what he means, that someone who played it too hard, it would have looked cheesy in a lot of respects.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the creative differences that ultimately stemmed in us getting a different movie than was originally drawn up. Because when the studio looked at it, they put together this teaser for them early in production, and the studio thought that they put like all the funny scenes in there. Well, or the scenes where you could, that had a comedic intent anyway. I don't know if people find them funny or not. But then when they were watching the finished product, the studio executives thought, it's like, man, what, we kind of thought we were getting a different movie than this. And then all that stuff kind of snowballed, and eventually Mel Gibson did say later on, in hindsight, that he was pretty much responsible for taking Brian Helgeland off the project.
And, I mean, the movie did well, so it's hard to say.
It did, and I think, again, like I know I already made the point, but just to reiterate, I think the movie, I don't know how, the alternate version is called Payback straight up. And it has a bunch of different, like, the soundtrack's different. And I don't know if it's a better or worse movie, but I definitely don't think it would have done as well commercially.
That subtitle is dog shit.
And it came out like it came out in 2006, you said? So it was like 6 or 7 years after this movie was released.
Yeah.
And you said I didn't catch this one in the theater, right?
I might have. I don't have a standout memory of it.
Yeah, I know I did, because one of the things about this movie that was kind of shocking at the time, especially, was that, you know, a lot of times when you see trailers, there's always some bullshit to make a scene look more exciting or more violent or turn out differently than it does. So I remember the trailers for this, that scene where he's in Carter's office, that's William Devane's character, as you already mentioned, and he says, "My buddy, yes or no?" And he goes, "No." And then he raises the gun and shoots. It's like, I remember going into the movie thinking, I remember that scene from the trailer, and I'm like, yeah, there's no way that's how it goes down. And that's exactly how it happens.
Right.
And it's like, oh, okay, so this character's a little different. Because I might be wrong on this, because I couldn't, like, take total stock of what, like, movies had been doing for the past decade. But, like, we weren't really big into anti-hero culture at this point, right?
It depends. Like, The Crow, you know, that's a big one that we've already talked about.
I mean, The Crow was definitely a good guy, though. He was a murder victim that came back to avenge him and his wife. Like,
yeah, you're right. Yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, I
was trying to,
I'm sure there's good examples, but
yeah, I was just trying to think about it, because I think, like, in a post Breaking Bad world, it's hard to think that maybe having a guy like an anti-hero, like a guy who, again, like I said, Mel Gibson's character is only likable in comparison to, like, Greg Henry's character, Val Resnick, and he was something else in this movie, man. I mean, like, when he has that line about how, like, the only problem with kicking a chow's ass is you want to do it again an hour later. And then, like, the scene before that, like, he's actually, like, he puts his leg through a broken car window to kick somebody in the face. It's
like, yeah, he...
like, this guy's a fucking trip with his cap teeth.
And just, you know, he's a sadist or whatever, and he likes getting the shit beat out of him by hookers, and he's just a wild dude. And I, you know, his death, I thought, was also like, okay, Porter's definitely not messing around, because he's like, you got a light? And he's like, no. And he's like, then what good are you? Pillow, gun, done. And then he pulls out his own lighter. So it's not like he wasn't, it wasn't a, like a one of these games like in Scream, like if you get the movie right or whatever, we're still going to kill you anyway. So maybe it was like Scream actually, but I love how he just like immediately after pops out the lighter and lights his cigarette. I'm like, that's a good, put that scene in the Mel Gibson montage at the, in the In Memoriam.
Yeah. And then just the heavy drag and like the, just the billowing cloud of smoke coming out. Just like,
yeah, exactly.
It looks like every fiber of his being is satisfied hitting that fucking cigarette. Like it's crazy.
like in old movies when they would like, everyone would always fire one up after sex. They would just be like,
well, that was, well, back then, I mean, that was code that sex happened, because that was basically because of the, I can't remember the name of that law that they passed, where it's like you couldn't like for like 3 decades you couldn't show anything remotely sexual on screen.
And they always had the, they always had like the fucking blanket all the way up to their neck.
Yeah, because that's how people sleep. Totally. Especially after they get done like bonking. It's like, yeah, let's, yeah, I want to be as covered up by a blanket as much as humanly possible. Like my core temperature's up a, like a degree and a half and I'm sweating like a pig. But yeah, let me get under this blanket.
You just like don't want to see yourself, so you just cover yourself. Yeah, no,
if that's the motivating factor, that's way more believable than than modesty.
Right. All right, so I mean, you know, we both like Mel Gibson's movies for sure. I mean, this one rounds out the 90s for him. This was after, you know, the final Lethal Weapon and after Braveheart. So this is sort of like, I don't want to say like the death rattle, but certainly a turning of the tide for him. I know, I think Signs came after this, but people even saw Signs as sort of like a welcome back Mel Gibson type of thing. So this was sort of an end of an era, so to speak, for Mel. You know, save me from forgetting maybe another movie or two that came after that were, you know, knockouts. But this one does fly under the radar a bit. Like when people talk about Mel Gibson, Payback doesn't roll off the tongue. And that might be a credit to him and his, you know, resume, of course, because immediately you fire off big time name movies. But I think for a lesser actor, this one probably is something that gets mentioned.
Yeah, with Mel Gibson, I mean, it's basically like, you know, the Road Warrior franchise. Sorry, the Mad Max franchise. I did the whole Game of Thrones malapropism. The Lethal Weapon franchise. If you want to sound smart, you name check the Year of Living Dangerously. Maverick, pretty fun movie.
Oh no.
That's the James Coburn connection, too.
Yeah. Wasn't a fan of Maverick, I'll be honest.
No. What, don't you just don't like westerns? You don't like poker movies? You don't...
I don't like Jodie Foster pretending she likes penis.
Well, what did you think of Maria Bello in this movie, then?
Fantastic.
Right. So, yeah. I guess right. You kind of take that on a case-by-case basis.
Yes. Yeah, I do.
Well, apparently, they one of the parts they had a hard... one of the only parts I really read about them having a hard time casting was for the Rosie part. And... Brian Helgeland claimed that he discovered Maria Bello going through a bunch of old audition tapes for the failed Superman remake in the 90s.
The Nick Cage one?
Yeah, I think she must have gone out for Lois Lane or something.
Brutal. Nick Cage looked like such a jackass in that outfit.
He didn't pick it. Like,
yeah, but he had the long hair and he had like the, you know, the very receding in Nick Cage mid-90s hair. Like, what was he thinking?
I don't know, man. I think he just won that Oscar for Leaving Las Vegas, and he just thought he could do whatever. And apparently he really loves the Superman character. It just didn't really translate to how, like how Ryan Reynolds allegedly loves Deadpool, and, like, those movies are actually, like, enjoyable, and they actually keep the comic book fans happy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Nick Cage named his son Kal-El.
Oh, that's right.
So, you know.
Yeah.
So his son's name, is this right? Kal-El Coppola Cage. Just, oh, God. Imagine being that kid. Anyway, big tangent. Maria Bello, fantastic. Although a little better in The History of Violence, if you ask me.
Yeah, History of Violence is a good one. I might have to revisit that at some point.
Yeah, Ed Harris rules.
Yeah, for some reason that line popped in my head the other day, and because, you know, I spend a lot of time by myself, I just said it like just to hear what it would sound like. He's like, why don't you ask your husband why he's so good at killing people?
Well, do you have any standout moments from Payback, or favorite scene or favorite line?
Well, I mentioned the scene with Carter from the trailer, because that really, quote unquote, subverted expectations before that came like a catch became like a catchphrase. But one of my favorite scenes when I was rewatching it, just for the humor of it, was when he's in the cab with Stegman and he has the gun on him. And then he and Stegman's like talking about like all the stuff he's gonna do, and he's been like taunting him for like half the movie, and then he just takes the gun away from him and he gives him and he's like, you're not gonna fucking kill me, are you? He just gives him this look, like, and he just starts bashing his head into the protective glass, and it was like just that unhinged Mel. Like, that was so that was probably one, like, I mean, I wouldn't say it's my favorite scene in the whole movie, but it definitely stood out the most when I was rewatching it, because I've seen this movie a bunch of times, but I hadn't seen it in a while. And yeah. Actually, that's not 100% true. I hadn't seen it in a while, and then like a week before I picked it, I just randomly watched it because I was like, I was in the mood to watch it. I was like, oh, Payback. But I also wanted to get back to, you'd made that kind of interesting, like, backdoor giggity Blade Runner comparison, where they had the voiceover, and the voiceover was another element that was missing from the original cut. So the original cut, everything's a little more ambiguous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the movie definitely has its dark humor, and I like that for whatever reason Porter, you know, maybe it's his military background and his discipline, but his insistence that it's only 70K throughout the movie, I just so I love that's one of my favorite parts, and it's just like this ongoing bit, and it doesn't matter what people say, and they're always telling him more. It's not like they're trying to rip him off and they're like 25K and he's like, no, it's 70. They're like $130,000. He's like, it's 70.
70. It was 70,000. Like, I also slept on how good, like, you mentioned how the movie kind of moves quick and it's streamlined. Like, it's short. I think it's only like an hour and 42 minutes or something. But that opening montage where he just does all the little, like, short cons to just, like, build himself back up. And you don't even really know what's going on at that point. Like, you kind of saw that he had recovered from some gunshot wounds, and they don't even really set a timetable for it, but then he's just in a suit, he's on the street, like, making moves, like, and just kind of establishing that he's a, you know, he's not a very likable guy, but then you get to like him over the course of the movie. Like, when he's sitting there counting out $100 bills and then just dashes on the steakhouse tab, it's like, okay, this is, or when he steals the waitress's cigarettes after giving her a 2-cent tip.
So he steals the bum's money and then he uses that to buy breakfast, and then she gives him cigarettes. He takes her entire pack, tips her shit, and then he steals a guy's wallet, goes to the bank, withdraws 300, buys the suit, buys the watches, pawns the watches to get the gun, and away we go. And then the dinner, like you said, he goes, run it again.
Impossible.
Run it again.
Apparently,
and
that guy
gets up and goes away.
That guy that he hits on the street, they put out an open casting call just to find a guy who looked like Mel Gibson. Like, he wasn't even an actor.
Really?
Yeah, because I guess Dave Talenda wasn't available. So.
Scuba.
That's one of our friends who bears a striking resemblance to Mel Gibson.
Yes. Yep.
Maybe not anymore. I don't know.
No.
No, I mean, because Mel Gibson got on the juice and he has that big crazy beard now. Knocked up a 28-year-old when he was 60.
Yeah, it'd be funny to see Dave with a big old Santa beard. You know what? You know that there'd be a ho 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 joke or two.
Indeed. Indeed. But yeah, what about you? What would be a standout scene for you? I mean, we just ran down like half the movie almost.
I mean, Lucy Liu, it's fantastic. But I mean, my favorite line is when she beats the shit out of Val. And then Mel knocks him out by kicking him in the face. And then she goes, I got a few minutes. And he goes, so go boil an egg.
Do you think she wanted to wanted him to rough her up? Or do you think she just wanted a bang?
Bang.
Oh, you think she wanted a bang? I thought her interests were more into dishing out, receiving corporal punishment. I thought that was more of her thing.
So in my head canon, he's already naturally that way. So she doesn't need to bring a side out of him that he hides from the rest of society. So she's like, I just want that cack.
It just made me think of another thing. Some of his when you see him being violent, it's always it's never I don't know if I want to put too much. I'm basing it off this one scene, but one of the scenes that I thought was hilarious was when he goes to shake down Stegman for the first time to find out what he knows, and that door dude is just not going to let him by, and he just stands up and he just sighs. And then the next scene, the dude's coming in holding his ear, and he's like, somebody wants to see you. You just know what happened. And he didn't want to do that.
I like that. And it almost seemed and I'm sure there's a moment I'm not thinking of, but every time he commits an act of violence, he seems very calm and very chill. Whether it's him, ripping out the piercings of that punk kid, or when he kills Resnick, or kills anybody, we're not seeing crazy Mel Gibson. We're seeing a pretty stoic, calm and reserved dude. And again, that could be because I didn't know this. I saw it on Wikipedia that Porter is an ex-Marine.
Well, yeah, he had the USMC tattoo on his arm.
There you go. So maybe that's the discipline and not getting too excitable when you do things that maybe he had done worse of overseas. Yeah, who knows? Make up the backstory. But it's not a crazy Mel Gibson. It's not, this isn't Lethal Weapon Mel Gibson.
No, it certainly isn't. And yeah. It might also tie to in real life. If a dude says he wants to fight and he's screaming and gesticulating and 90% of the time you don't have to worry about a guy like that. It's the guy who's just yeah, okay. it's just another day at the office for him. That's probably gonna be a bad day for you.
Yeah, that's a good point.
If you see that through, I don't know. I don't remember the last time I was even remotely close to being in a bar fight or anything like that, but.
Oh, yeah, please. Those days are long gone, right? But it was cool seeing, Bill Duke, who, we've done several Bill Duke movies at this point.
That's right.
It's cool seeing him in this. And, that guy, Jack Conley, who I've seen in a bunch of things, and I was like, where do I really fucking know this guy from? And you know what it was? He's the guy who was, I don't know if I should say this. Have you seen Sons of Anarchy?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sure most of our audience has. He's the guy responsible for Opie's death.
Oh, okay.
He's the prison guard, the leader of the prison guards who sort of made it all happen.
Yeah, that was rough.
Yeah. So I was like, that fucking guy. And then he got his, which was also nice. But yes, but it's funny seeing both those, corrupt detectives when they had Porter outside of the car, because it reminds you. And also there's a scene with Maria Bello, too, that they don't try to hide Mel Gibson's shortness in this movie. He's not and I don't know if that's on purpose because they want Porter to not feel like this imposing figure, because sort of going back to Roger Ebert's quote, if this was made, if you plugged Prime Arnold into this movie, it's just another Commando. It's another ridiculous Arnold movie. But they go with even though he's a Marine, he sort of looks like this accessible sort of regular dude.
Yeah, it's almost kind of what they did with Tom Cruise in Collateral.
Bingo. Yes.
That was one of the reasons I mentioned that movie pretty often and I like it so much is because Tom Cruise went out of his way to really kind of do what actors used to do and kind of blend into the role as opposed to, oh, it's just Tom. It's kind of I know I've said this once or twice before, and it's certainly not to bash the guy because he's an icon and a legend. But it's if you see a Denzel Washington movie, it's Denzel Washington is just playing himself. It's just, oh, it's Denzel Washington's a CIA agent in this one. Denzel Washington's just a, I don't know. But people love to see it. Like, that's why the guy's so popular, because...
But that's why Training Day was so good, because he was playing a bad dude for once.
Yeah, yeah. Playing against type, kind of like Mel was here, I think.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. No, that's, I mean, that's a fair point about Denzel. But
I just always bring that up as an example, because it just seems like ever since he did Malcolm X, it was like he just kind of just... He, like, if you can get paid $20 million to show up and just be yourself, hey, that's awesome.
And what did Tom Cruise do for Collateral? Like, just stop dyeing his hair?
Well, he stopped dyeing his hair, and then he, like, you know, he wore, like, nondescript clothing. Like, part of his whole training was he actually went around and, like, delivered packages as a UPS guy to see if he wouldn't get recognized.
Because
he thought an important part of the character was being like, what's the word I'm looking for? Just kind of, like... discreet, hard to spot.
Yeah. Do you think he was slipping Scientology pamphlets into those packages?
I don't know. I don't think so. Maybe. I can't rule anything out, really.
Yeah. But I bet, like, there's probably perks to being in that cult, you know?
There seem to be.
Yeah. Yeah, like Leah Remini walking around. You're like, all right.
Unless you're Danny Masterson. I mean, apparently that dude was just so heinous, they couldn't even help him.
Jeez, yeah. Yeah, he's, life in prison, right?
I think he's doing at least 30 years. I'm not acquainted with the details of the case because I know this might sound a little weird, but I'm not like, I don't really like getting into the details of like, of rape cases. Like, I'm just not.
No, yeah.
That's not my bag, baby.
No, that is not our bag on this podcast. I'm sure there's a true crime podcast that focuses only on rape. So go look them up and listen to those idiots.
I wonder that. That's probably extremely uplifting. Ugh. Jesus. Man, like, there probably is. I mean, there's one for everything. Man, you guys are really off track. I know. But
don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Yeah. All right. So what do you think of the villains overall in the movie? Bottom?
I thought it was a little interesting how the characters in this movie were more like, they were kind of more like corporate than they were, like when William Devane's like, we don't want any more unpleasantness at the hotel, and he's like putting lip balm on, he's wearing a vest. It's like, this isn't exactly what you think of when you think of criminal middle management, but... They kind of reimagined it that way, that there was at the upper levels, at least, there were, you know, these guys who were kind of more like, I don't know, executives. But I mean, I thought they all brought a little something to movie. Like, even the guy who played Phil, John Glover, who's another one of those that guy actors. Like, he was like the evil scientist in Gremlins 2. And
yes.
Was he also the evil scientist in Batman and Robin?
Dude, you're going to ask me to remember someone from fucking Batman and Robin? I watched that movie once, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he was in that, though.
Oh, God.
No, he wasn't the evil scientist at Gremlins 2. He was like the Donald Trump guy. He was like the Donald Trump stand-in. He was like the magnate that owned the building.
Oh, he played Daniel Clamp.
That's right.
He was also in your favorite movie of all time, by the way.
Was he in Goldmember?
You fucking scumbag.
I thought that's what you were setting up.
No, not at that level, but goddamn you, man. No, RoboCop 2. RoboCop Harder.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, yes. He played Magnavolt Salesman.
Oh, yeah. See, I don't even remember that at all.
Was he that movie's I'll buy that for a dollar guy?
No, I don't think so. I don't remember a whole lot about RoboCop 2. RoboCop 2 was a little out there. Like, RoboCop, one of the main villains was like a kid. Like this really mean, like 10-year-old kid.
I mean, they got the cast to return for it, but we don't need to get into it. Hopefully we're not doing RoboCop 2 on the pod, but you know, we'll see.
I think that would be a long way down the road. Like, maybe kind of a revisit.
Episode 180.
Saw that in the theater with my family.
Oh, I'm sure you did. I'm sure you saw RoboCop 3 also.
No, I did not see RoboCop 3.
Oh, all right.
They made it PG-13, and they replaced Peter Weller. Even when I was 12, I knew that was a shit deal. good instincts.
His lips look different, mommy. Yeah, so that dude, John Glover, like, it did feel a little like they were doing nods to cliches in this movie with, like, the henchmen and stuff. And he's like, you want any evidence? You want any, you know?
Any Polaroids or trophies? No, not this time.
And it's almost like I felt like I was playing Arkham City. And they were like, you know, the bad guys in the street. Like, it's the bat! Like, you know, like one of those guys. But it worked, though. I had a real fun time watching this movie. I think maybe I wish there was a bit more with the... I don't know if it's revenge. It's sort of revenge. But I think the Christofferson thing was rushed a bit. And all of a sudden he's got this son. And he buys in this car. And he gets hoodwinked with the, you know, the whole situation with Maria Bello's character. That, I don't know, that all felt a little like shoehorned in.
Well, it was.
And I know, well, I know, but you can still shoehorn an idea in and make it feel like it's been there the whole time, you know?
Yeah, because originally the Bronson character was just a woman's voice on the phone. Like, you never, like, he never got close to Bronson in the original cut.
And little did we find out, it was Bronson all along. But what do you think about performance-wise for Mel Gibson? Where does this stack up for you?
Oh, it's up there. I mean, it's not like, you know, it's kind of hard for me to top, in the Mel Gibson catalog, to top Martin Riggs as a character, at least in the first two Lethal Weapon movies. Like, in three and four, he's kind of like a different guy. Like,
oh, 100% agree. But yeah, especially four. Yeah.
They make, I mean, at least they're smart enough to draw attention to it. Like, especially in four, he's always talking about how he's getting old and he can't, like, do the spin kicks like he used to and can't run as fast. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of like when you take a character like Riggs and you, like, give him a love interest. I mean, they did it too, but then that didn't really play out so well. And then in three, it's like, I don't know. It's kind of like taking something about a character that fundamentally and changing it. I don't know. Maybe I'm off base on that. Good boy, you seem to agree with me, at least, which is good.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because at this point we saw like really serious Mel Gibson and we've seen like crazy wild manic Mel Gibson. So I think doing a movie like this, like I'm sure when he made this movie, Mel Gibson wasn't thinking like, oh, I'm going to win an award for this one, you know?
Yeah, I don't think so either. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how actors make those determinations when they're, but like, because we've talked about movies before that have had a very tumultuous productions and they just, but the final product is very well received and very successful. Gladiator comes to mind. Speaking of which, man, I did not realize that Oppenheimer was such a huge deal. Like, it won 7 Oscars, and I was like, man, I should have seen that.
I haven't seen it either. I have a, like, isn't that like 3.5 hours long?
Yeah, but if it's good, it doesn't matter. It's like, I always use the Godfather as an example. Like, if people bitch about a movie being long, I would say, well, nobody bitches about the Godfather being long.
Oh, yeah.
And it's long as hell.
Yeah, that movie rules.
It does rule. You're right. But yeah, I would definitely put this up there with, I mean, it's not like his best performance, but like the character is just so different, at least at the time. I mean, now, I mean, those kinds of characters are a lot more common, but I just remember in the 90s, it wasn't, my memory of the 90s was there weren't a lot of anti-hero characters like this. Where they do morally questionable things, but it's in service of an underlying code. And you were kind of astute to point that out, that maybe it had something to do with his military rear, like his like time in the Marine Corps. I don't know, but the only thing that really separates him from the other characters in the movie is that he seems to have a code, and the other ones don't. Mm-hmm. And I know that's kind of a cliche, but at the same time, it definitely seems to be accurate. Whereas everybody else is just concerned about, you know, just being evil for its own sake and making sure the criminal enterprise runs unabated.
Yeah, I wonder if, I mean, they probably could have amped up the romantic angle a bit between him and Rosie. especially being seeing how like his story with his wife ended, because by the end, I don't know, with a movie like this, even though it is sort of like a callback and it's noir and he is this like anti-hero, you still want your protagonist to have something to lose. And if he died at the end, it would have been like, oh, he orphaned this kid, or he had this, you know, this new love or something like that. And there, he did have that with Rosie, but it was very ambiguous by the end, where she winds up driving, being his driver, and he's like, just drive. I feel like maybe the end would have had a bigger payoff if he did have a bit more to lose beyond his, you know, life and 70 grand. Or 70 grand.
Well, can you imagine how different it would have been if they revealed that, you know, the wife's impetus for betraying him was seeing a picture of them together. And in the original version,
right,
he tells her that picture was taken before he and his wife met. And somehow Resnick got his hands on it, which is... So, I mean, like, it's not like this movie's above criticism. Like, some of the stuff you mentioned.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then, you mentioned the Bronson thing felt kind of tacked on, which once you read it, it totally makes sense. Once you read about how that all happened, the love story feels a little tacked on because it was more, I think in the original version, it might have been more that it was like helping an old friend or remembering an old friend, and maybe a romance blossomed, but that wasn't it wasn't as immediate as this movie portrayed it. Or this,
yeah,
the mainstream version of the movie did. But like when I was watching, like, some of the things were just way too convenient. But that's sometimes how these movies go. It's like you've got this guy who knows all the angles, and he figures out what he's gonna do, and he's always like a couple steps ahead of everybody, even when stuff goes really wrong.
Yeah, that's a good point. I did like seeing him get the best of people who were trying to like screw him over and stuff. Like the scene you brought up, you know, with David Paymer, Stegman?
Yeah.
Like, that's good. And that guy always seems, I wish I could pinpoint all the examples, but he always seems to play a little weasel.
Yeah, that's unfortunate, but it's, I don't know, he's
like,
still in the game.
I almost pinned him to the Punisher, but I don't think he was in that, was he? The Thomas Jane one?
I don't think so, but interestingly enough, I think Brian Helgeland directed that too, didn't he?
Did he?
I think he did. Check my work, please.
Yeah, I will.
I asked nicely because that's not how we do things around here. We don't boss each other around.
Check it now!
Check it!
You shut up!
You keep your mouth shut! You shut check it!
No, you're wrong.
Oh, am I?
Yeah.
Who directed it?
It's Jonathan Hensley.
Oh, that's right.
The famous Jonathan Hensley of the Ice Road fame.
Did he direct Surrogates too, or was that Jonathan Mostow?
He did not direct that.
Okay.
He directed, the first thing he directed was The Punisher. And then Kill the Irishman. I mean, he did some shitty shit, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, not that guy. So you were wrong, Mike. A rare miss.
I'm wrong a lot.
For the ace of the staff. Speaking of ace of the staff, Mike, the Yankees haven't even started yet, and Gerrit Cole's getting elbow MRIs. I'm finished, Mike. I'm finished. God, it's like that line from A Bronx Tale when the kid grows up. He's like. I remember 6 years old, always worrying about what Mickey Mantle was going to do that day. And then you grow up and you got all the shit going on, and you're like, I don't give a fuck about what the Yankees are doing, or something like that. You know, I'm paraphrasing. But it's like, I couldn't give a shit. But anyway, back to the subject at hand, Payback. I enjoyed seeing him, like I said, whether it's torturing somebody to get info, which ends up happening to him at the end too. I think he loses two toes in the process. But... Or just how calmly and coolly he took people out or swindled people. Very smooth. And I think that's another aspect of this movie. You know, Mel Gibson always sort of had that charisma. But Porter specifically, it's just very smooth in how he operated. Now, he would constantly run into obstacles and get the shit kicked out of him, which maybe made you root for him more because he wasn't this, like, you know, superhuman, like Dutch or somebody from, you know, an 80s Arnold movie. But he just very smooth and cool. And, like, I could see myself, you know, as a teenager watching and, like, almost being like, man, I wish I was, like Mel Gibson right now on screen, you know? Just how fucking cool the character was.
Yeah, yeah, and, like, some of the other things, like, how they... Because the novel this was adapted from was called The Hunter. And in some of the scenes, you kind of see that, like, that's what he is. Like, he sizes people up. Like, when he's sizing up the job that Resnick takes him on, and he's like, yeah, did you notice something? Those guys weren't wearing their seatbelts. It's like, oh, who would have noticed that? And then come up with this plan. It's like, oh, I'll just hit him in a head-on collision. And just like, it'll be like a literal smash and grab.
Death proof before death proof.
Yeah, except no furious masturbation into the dashboard. We got stuff to do. We can't be firing greasy loads on the dashboard. We got to take this. We got to take this laundered money. And
oh,
bounce.
Kurt Russell would have crushed this movie too, man.
Well, Kurt, in your opinion, what movie would Kurt Russell have not have crushed?
Mrs. Doubtfire.
Okay. Okay.
Yep. Yep.
What about anything that Daniel Day-Lewis was in?
Yes. I think he would not have crushed Last of the Mohicans.
Do you think he could have saved The Piano? What if you had Holly Hunter, Anna Paquin, and Kurt Russell instead of Harvey Keitel? Oh,
man. I mean, he did play Elvis, so you never know.
I don't even know what that fucking movie is about.
I think it's about a piano.
No. Because I watched some other movie that she directed, Jane Campion, and I was bored to tears. Like, it was fucking brutal. I can't even remember the name of it or who was in it. All I remember is that it was incredibly boring.
So the film focuses on a mute Scottish woman who travels to a remote part of New Zealand with her young daughter after her arranged marriage to a frontiersman, doesn't work out. Or it does work out. And then there's a piano involved. Oh, maybe, let me guess. She speaks through the piano, I bet. Ada and Flora, along with their handcrafted piano, are stranded on a New Zealand beach by a ship's crew. Oh, God, I'm going to fall asleep right now.
You're reading the description just here.
Who the fuck went to go see this movie?
And I'm like, dude,
movie?
Are you asleep? You're like, huh, what?
Do you know what the piano is? The piano is the movie that everybody hates, but they don't want to admit that they don't like it because they don't want to look like they're not cultured.
Like The English Patient.
Yes. Yes, Seinfeld crushed that.
They did. So I really good. Need to rewatch Seinfeld.
Seinfeld. It's even better now. Because, like, people are trying to retroactively cancel Seinfeld for some of its bits. But it's so good. It's a very rewatchable show. Michael Richards is a fucking king. Aside from that one day.
He had a bad day. Yeah, he had a real bad day at the office.
A real bad day. Had a bad day. Real bit.
Speaking of bad day at the office, we haven't really talked about. I mean, you mentioned her in passing, but the Lucy Liu character in this,
yes,
the, like, kind of hooker, kind of not,
yes,
kind of tied up with the triads,
with the triad for sure. Yeah. Yep. Nice. You know me. I'm a big Tarantino guy. Not the biggest Kill Bill fan, but I liked her in that too. So. Not everything she's done, but I always thought she was attractive. I thought she was a good actress.
I was going to ask what you thought of her in the, Charlie's Angels films.
Oh yes. The Charlie's Angels films. Not a big fan of those. So I'm sure she did fine. Yeah. Drew Barrymore, like, came back for that though. I got to give her that.
Yeah. Those movies are. Not for me. We'll just put it that way.
Yeah.
I mean, they're probably the funny thing is those things are probably like a country mile better than that one they came out with like 3 or 4 years ago that Elizabeth Banks directed.
Oh, God. Elizabeth Banks. Did you see that? Now we're going on a big tangent, but whatever. I'll round it out. Did you see her at some award show calling out Steven Spielberg for never casting a lead woman? And then someone in the crowd yelled The Color Purple, and she's like, oh, yeah, sorry. It's like, you're going to call, like, how dumb do you have to be like, you know, an actor who's just starting to try to become a director and try to call out the greatest director in the history of movies for something that's not accurate? What a fucking idiot.
Yeah, she kind of peaked at the 40-year-old virgin, really.
She should go boil an egg. Anyway, what do you think of Lucy Liu? You know, you keep asking me, because I think you even asked me prior to this. So I'm curious where you're at with Lucy Liu.
Oh, she's very easy on the eyes.
Okay, there we are. There we are. Very nice.
As an actress, yeah, she was interesting in this part. I just remember that, like, there was that whole thing with where Bill Murray was bashing her, which was...
Oh, yeah. Well, she was bashing Bill Murray, saying he was difficult to work with.
And then he just went the medium talent route, because that seems to work for him. He can pull that off. No, I thought she was, I don't know. I don't really want to get to, I never really got the whole Maria Bello thing. I never really got it, but.
You've seen The History of Violence, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. They 69 okay. sideways. It's all very erotic. Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. That's fine. Well, there have to be other elements of this movie we could talk about. You know, we're only coming up on an hour. But it is a very streamlined film. It's hard to, like, unless we start going through every scene.
Man. Nobody wants to. I mean, we already kind of did that already. We've already, like, kind of talked about, like, at least a third of the scenes of the movie have been referenced, or we haven't, like, acted them out or anything, but...
yeah, no, and nobody wants us to do that.
Or do they?
Me and Mike just keep the recording going, and we each drive to the local gas station to buy cigarettes, and then we come back, and we're just sitting here smoking, doing the dialogue.
I haven't wanted a cigarette that much in a while. So when I was rewatching this movie, I was like, ugh.
I've had a couple of cheat ones here and there. I'm not going to lie. At the Pantera concert and shit like that. But I, you know, aside from that, I haven't really smoked at all. So it's been good. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to say much more about the movie. It's enjoyable if, you know, for people who listen to the pod and then decide where they're going to watch a movie, definitely go check this one out because it's a fun movie and it's, you know, they don't make a ton of these like this anymore because I feel like everything either has to be part of a franchise or it's a sequel, it's a reboot. And ironically, I realize this is a remake to a certain degree, but it's not the way they do it today where everything is almost like shot for shot redone just with a new cast.
Yeah, and this focus group to death, or they... You know, they take an established property and they just, like, randomly swap out the identities of crucial characters just for the altar of representation. Even though that does nothing for anything. It doesn't do anything for the quality of the movie. It doesn't make it better. My understanding is that even... So John Borman, the guy who directed Point Blank, which came out in 1967... He was a little salty that they were remaking this. Like he was bad mouthing the script, and he said this reminded him of like a shittier version of the movie that he directed. And I was just, it's like, man, I could, when I first heard that, I was kind of like, man, these old timey industry people that just have to gatekeep the original intellectual property. It's like, but then like, I kind of get his point. Because I think about what's going on now with how little original stuff is being developed. And I could see that being really frustrating. But
it's hard to say. You know, there are still good movies being made. I mean, for sure. But I don't know if like a movie like this that made $160 million, like that's massively successful in 1999. Like that's a huge, I remember $100 million was like this benchmark and people were always like, man, Adam Sandler's hit like three of those in a row. And I remember like anytime a certain movie came out that didn't come with a large fanfare, hits 100 million, people are like, holy shit, that movie made a ton of money. And now it feels like, yeah, it was 25 years ago, but now it feels like that is just pennies. For and I know budgets are inflated now too, but even this movie had a $90 million budget. Like, this movie didn't make a ton of money. It probably made a lot in DVD sales, like we were saying. Everyone had this. That was our age. Everyone had this movie. And I don't remember this having a ton. It was a pretty basic DVD package. It wasn't like, you know, you got a 2-hour, I don't even know if there's a commentary, you know, or a making of. I think there were deleted scenes maybe and stuff like that.
I think there was a commentary, but it didn't come out for years after the initial release. So probably when people were first buying it, it didn't have it. But then, like,
yeah,
in 2005, 2006, they had a commentary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think you'll ever watch the alternate version?
I'll check it out. Sure. If I could find it, I would check it out just to see how different it is. I'm not like, if it's really bad, like 10 minutes in, I'll probably shut it off. Like, I don't know. I'm not going to sit through basically the same movie, but different, but just shit.
Yeah, I mean, even with a movie like Orgasmo, where they had an alternate cut, and you watch it, and you're just, it's so different from the original, and it's like even with that one, how they talk about how they changed the music and stuff, I could see how that would be really off-putting. Like, you're watching it, and it, like you mentioned the score, like, it has kind of this jazzy kind of, like, city, like, all, like, in a lot of cases, upbeat kind of feel to it, like, where it's just like, it's or like at least up tempo, because the movie always has this momentum. Like, it's always you get the one flashback, but then it's always to set everything up, but then it's always kind of moving forward.
Yeah.
But like, I am very curious. I kind of wish I had seen it before we did this, but I was like, I just couldn't get it done. But I'm very curious, because I still maintain that I don't know if it'd be better, but I just don't think it definitely wouldn't have worked in the cultural zeitgeist of the late 90s, because I don't think people were really looking to revisit 70s cinema, which is a lot more challenging thematically and narratively in a lot of ways. Like, a movie I reference a lot is Vanishing Point, which is this movie that really doesn't have a point at all. But in the 70s, like, a lot of these independent studios were taking chances on movies like that.
That is also a good point. I don't think the risks are there as much anymore, and that's why I feel like movies like this are going to become more and more few and far between. But I think modern technology and, like, cell phones, like AI, like really anything that can prevent conflicts in terms of communication or whatever, hinders some elements of storytelling. Like, you can always go back, like, if I don't know if you've done this, Mike, I'm sure we maybe even done this, where we take an older movie like Die Hard or something, and like, if that came out today, they would just go on the internet and be like, hey, I am at Nakatomi Plaza, and, you know, whatever, movie over. And it's like, I think they need to go back to doing sort of what, you know, Tarantino does to some extent, but doing period stuff. And, like, to tell a good story, like, they're going to have to set some more movies in the 80s, in the 90s, you know, 70s or whatever. And maybe your environmental budget will be more expensive unless you scout a nicely aged area. But there's more romance, and I don't mean actual love romance, but there's more romance you could put in your storytelling when you don't have the preventative measures provided by, like, technology and things of today.
It's an interesting perspective. You're saying what's going to revitalize cinema is more period pieces.
Yeah, but I don't mean, like, hundreds of years back. I mean, just pop it back a few decades, you know, everyone has a phone or something like that, and you could be a little bit more creative in the conflicts within your storytelling, in my opinion. Because people always feel like the one they go to, like, oh, Home Alone. Like, we probably said it on our fucking Home Alone podcast because we're not creative and we're stupid. And we probably said, like, oh, imagine he just all he had to do is have a cell phone or the internet, and he just pops on and he says, hey, mom, emails his mom, you forgot me. And she sees it on her phone. She's like, we got to go back and get Kevin. We'll take a flight 2 hours later, movie over. No movie. So, you know what I mean? Am I making sense or not at all?
No, you're making sense.
Fuck.
You just, you got to remember that it'll be interesting, like, when your kids get older and, you know, the kids, the other kids in your circle get older, and it's like they're going to have no idea what stuff used to be like. Like, I was thinking about that the other day about how, and I don't mean to sound like an elitist here, but I just feel as if people are getting just dumber and their social skills are just collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
And, but then if you watch like an old movie from the 50s and the way people banter, like they talk really fast and there's patter, there's like all kinds of, and granted it's movies, but I think people talk like that in real life too. Like, it was just like people just kind of talked like it was like a rapid fire exchange of all this of puns and, you know, plays on words and things like that. And those people probably thought like the young people they saw in the 80s were stupid because they don't talk like that anymore. And I think maybe that's part of it. I think I'm just getting old and curmudgeonly, and I just, things are changing and I'm not adapting well.
I don't know who, I was probably talking to you because I don't talk to a lot of people about like the nuances of movies and like in a nerdy way, but I think it was you who said like the way dialogue's written today feels way too deliberate and not conversational. And I forget what movie we were talking about where it was done so well that we were like, it felt like a real flow of a conversation. It didn't feel like, and now I'm going to make this person say this sort of thing, where today's dialogue does feel like there's always intent behind every single line and less naturally conversational.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that sounds like something I would say. Maybe we're, wait,
was it might
have
even been Rocky. I don't remember what it was, but I'm pretty sure it was you who said that. But so, and I agree.
Yeah. What did you think of the dialogue in this movie? A little too.
I thought it was good. Yeah. A lot of tongue in cheek stuff, which, you know, there, a lot of stuff made me laugh, and I'm sure there were parts that maybe weren't even necessarily funny that made me laugh too. I even liked when he was just like, you know, ripping people off and walking out on the waitress and her being pissed about the cigs, or walking out on the dinner, or, you know, whatever. But I thought it was, yeah, I thought everything was pretty smooth and, you know, well-written. I know the director got fired, but overall, like, what they put together for a screenplay worked for me. I do have one interesting piece of trivia here for you, Mike. So the composer, we talked about it, Chris Boardman, not a, you know, a popular name amongst composers that would roll off the tongue or show up in a trivia contest by any means, but he has a connection to Mel Gibson because apparently he was in the music department for Lethal Weapon. And he was an additional orchestrator under, was it Michael Kamen, right?
Yep. Yeah. I don't know. You might want to double check me.
Stop it. You know what's Kamen. Come on. Give it to me. Eric Clapton and Michael Kamen. What the hell did Clapton do for Lethal Weapon? Did he have a song?
The guitar riff.
In the white room.
Hey, we're playing our 17th version of Layla. It's like, God damn it. I'm not going to say that song's not a classic, but when I hear like a different, like, soft rock version of Layla, it's like, how many versions of this shit is there?
It's Eric Clapton's fault for the unplugged performance. That's it. So then everyone's like, oh, well, we have the acoustic version, so then it's okay for all the other versions to be made. And then you have the piano part at the end, which some people just do on their own and make that their own thing. Fucking Goodfellas. Jesus Christ. But yeah, that's kind of cool, though. He was, you know, part of the, I don't know what additional orchestrators do, but he was on the staff of the Lethal Weapon music department.
Very interesting. Cool. I did not know that one.
Yeah. For sure. So, so what, 12 years later, he's, maybe Mel liked him. Maybe he knew Mel, or they developed some sort of friendship, or who knows, but he got him on board to be the composer for this, and he doesn't have a vast resume by any stretch of the imagination, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah, because the only, like, one of the other connections was, you know, James Coburn being in this from Maverick, and one of the funny things from the set that it was just this random stupid thing that happens on Hollywood sets was they wanted his character to smoke cigars, but he didn't like the cigars that they gave him, so he just stole them out of Mel's trailer.
Oh, the irony. Wow. Imagine he went into Mel's trailer and Mel was just doing weird shit in there.
Like, yeah, just like running around in his underwear and like just ranting and raving about
just memorizing Bible verses.
Yeah, just like ranting and raving about the Old Testament, like on a South Park portrayal.
His only begotten son. No, it's New Testament. But screaming it like in Ransom. Give me back my son. Fucking Gary Sinise.
Did we shortchange Greg Henry a little bit? We talked about him a little bit, but
let's pay him some respect right now. Greg Henry, go ahead.
I mean, I already mentioned that. Apparently, I couldn't find a citation for this, but apparently they said that he was like, when he auditioned, that they thought he was like the only choice for Val Resnick, even though other actors were interested. They didn't specify which ones, but or the little piece of trivia I did. But like I said, the portrayal of him being like a sadist and a masochist, and then just kind of just being a little off.
But yeah.
Like just the way he's like so aggressively unpleasant, like where he's like the dude in the restaurant, and he like just takes fries off his like a fry off his plate and just starts eating it. Like, what are you gonna do?
That's true. That's true. I was trying to think of like what else I knew him from. Do you know him? Does anything else stand out to you that you've seen that you remember him like enjoying him in?
He was in this movie I watched where he was in a movie with Sting's wife, and I can't remember the name of it, but it was like
she had time to do movies.
I mean, he has time to go on tour, so she had time to do movies, at least in the 80s. But he was like this evil husband, and he finds out his wife's cheating on him, and he releases a snake in the house and like locks her in the house with this poisonous snake, and the whole movie is her like trying to outwit this poisonous. So it was like the proto snakes on a plane, but it was just one chick in a house.
one snake, one chick.
Yeah, it's like a chick in a house with a snake. But the guy who did Snakes on a Plane is like, no, we can do way better than this.
Oh, my God. Well, they were going to name it The Chick versus the Python, but that's what we call all of your sexual exploits.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, we got him.
I don't want to do this anymore.
Oh, man. Oh, he plays, who's Jason Quill? Is that in Guardians of the Galaxy. Is that his, like, stepfather or something like
that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. All right. That's who he plays. So he's a scumbag, right? Isn't he not a good guy? I don't remember.
I don't either.
Mel Gibson, Kurt Russell was his real dad. That's all that matters.
That's true. No, it's just funny because he has that, like, he has that face kind of. I'm not really one to talk, but he's not really, like, a conventionally handsome dude, and then he's just, like, all ripped up. It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, that's true. He plays usually a bad guy, right?
Yeah, usually. Like, it's kind of like that dude, I don't know the actor's name, but he was in Slapshot, and he was also the detective from Jerky Boys, and he has that face like he's like a detective from the 20s, but then he's just like got this like ripped up body. It's like, oh, okay. Those two things really don't go together, but
are you talking about the Jerky Boys movie?
Yeah.
Do you know, as much as I love the Jerky Boys, I don't know if I've ever watched the movie.
Dude, it's so, the Jerky Boys movie, they have Tom Jones singing Are You Gonna Go My Way, and I thought he did the original version and Lenny Kravitz covered it, and it was the other way around. Tom Jones rules, by the way.
Yeah. What, Sex Bomb's your song, right? Don't you like that song?
No, She's a Lady.
She's a Lady, yeah. Never heard of it. I'm just kidding. I've heard of it. All right, Mike.
We out of road.
Anything else on Payback?
I think we're out of road. No, I think I knew this would kind of be a shorter one because, like you said, the movie is pretty streamlined. It's short in and of itself. But I really enjoyed revisiting it. I hope you did too. I think the movie still holds up. It's just it's interesting looking back on it now, because I think it was a little edgier, even with how Mel Gibson and the team involved kind of softened it up with the reshoots and everything. I still think this movie was pretty edgy for the time it came out. Now it probably doesn't really stack up to like when you have movies like Midsommar that exist, or like Funny Games that are just movies that are like aggressively unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, by the way, random. I just saw a trailer for this movie.
Roadhouse?
No, Jesus Christ, no. no.
I'm excited to see it. I'm not going to lie. It's right to Amazon. I don't have to put pants on.
Well, yeah. Any day you don't have to put pants on is a win. no, but it's that movie. It's like from the same team that did Barbarian. It's like the devil on like late night TV or something. I can't remember the title of it.
Was it a new movie?
No, I'll send you a trailer after we're done, which should be shortly, because I think this has been our discussion on Payback. Do you have any closing remarks before you tell us where we're going next?
No, but it was nice to revisit it, because it did bring me back to sort of, you know, 16, 17 years old and enjoying the movie. And I was surprised at how many of the lines I remembered. So that was nice. That was a nice little revisit. All right, so it's on me.
It is.
This is a tough one. I kind of want to go off the rails a little bit, but I also want to like put out just something that's digestible and widely known. So I'm stuck on two movies. I'm gonna go with the fun one. I don't know. You might not even be a fan, but I don't know if you like Robert Zemeckis at all, but I was talking about period pieces, and what better way to do that than to tackle the first Back to the Future.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. All right. I mean, this movie's a classic. It really is.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Yeah, that should be a good one.
I know you're not the biggest, you know, Spielberg-ish guy, and it definitely falls in that because he produced it. But we'll see what you have to say on a rewatch.
Sounds good, man. Now you got my interest piqued about what the weird one was. But you're gonna have to keep that in your back pocket.
You don't want me to just tell you?
Nah,
it's not even that weird.
Nah.
Oh, fine. Do you think Julie Michaels is gonna be in the Roadhouse remake?
I don't think so, buddy.
Shit.
Did you?
By the way.
Was she holding up well? I don't remember.
Yes.
Shockingly well for being like 58 or whatever.
Fantastic. My God.
Oh, good for her.
Yeah.
It's late night with the devil. I don't know why I couldn't piece that together, but it has that weird dude from The Dark Knight and Suicide Squad and the Suicide Squad in it.
Oh, that dude?
Yeah.
Yeah, that dude is weird.
Yeah, and I think I don't know if it's the same director, but it said a couple of the people from Barbarian were involved in it. So I definitely want to check it out.
Yeah, me too. No doubt about it. All right. Well, that is it. That is the pick. Back to the Future next. Hope everyone enjoyed our chat on Payback. Make sure you're subbed to the show, your favorite pod apps, and tell your friends who like movies and keep pointing them in our direction, because we like to have a good time here. A tangent heavy episode, but we hope we covered every aspect of Payback that you wanted us to talk about. But your feedback, always welcome, of course. So be sure to hit us up on social media, Just the Movies on X, Just Like the Movies Pod on Instagram, Just Like the Movies Pod at gmail.com. If you want to send us an email, we will send it directly to our spam folder. All right, we'll be back likely 2 weeks as always with another episode here on Just Like the Movies. So, Mike, anything else?
No, man. Thank you so much.
All right, from us here at Just Like the Movie, be kind, rewind, relax, and see you right.
Hubba, hubba, hubba.